The Shadow Line, A Confession, by Joseph Conrad. Worthy of my undying regard. To Boris and all others who, like himself, have crossed in early youth the shadow line of their generation with love. Part 1. The Shadow Line, Daughter Foyce, Cam Platt, Grand Miroir de Monde des Espoirs. Baudelaire, I, only the young have such moments. I don't mean the very young. No. The very young have, properly speaking, no moments. It is the privilege of early youth to live in advance of its days in all the beautiful continuity of hope which knows no pauses and no introspection. One closes behind one the little gate of mere boyishness and enters an enchanted garden. Its very shades glow with promise. Every turn of the path has its seduction. And it isn't because it is an undiscovered country. One knows well enough that all mankind that stream that way. It is the charm of universal experience from which one expects an uncommon, or personal sensation, a bit of one's own. One goes on recognizing the landmarks of the predecessors, excited, amused, taking the hard luck and the good luck together, the kicks and the halfpence. As the saying is, the picturesque common lot that holds so many possibilities for the deserving, or perhaps for the lucky. Yes, one goes on. And the time, too, goes on till one perceives ahead a shadow line warning one that the region of early youth, too, must be left behind. This is the period of life in which such moments, of which I have spoken, are likely to come. What moments? Why, the moments of boredom, of weariness, of dissatisfaction. Rash moments. I mean moments when the still young are inclined to commit rash actions, such as getting married suddenly or else throwing up a job for no reason. This is not a marriage story. It wasn't so bad as that with me. My action, rash as it was, had more the character of divorce, almost of desertion. For no reason on which a sensible person could put a finger, I threw up my job, chucked my berth, left the ship, of which the worst that could be said was that she was a steamship and therefore, perhaps, not entitled to that blind loyalty which... However, it's no use trying to put a gloss on what even at the time I myself half suspected to be a caprice. It was in an eastern port. She was an eastern ship, inasmuch as then she belonged to that port. She traded among dark islands on a blue reef-scarred sea, with the red ensign over the taffrail, and at her masthead a house flag, also red, but with a green border, and with a white crescent in it. For an Arab owned her, and a side at that. Hence the green border on the flag. He was the head of a great house of Straits Arabs, but as loyal a subject of the complex British Empire as you could find east of the Suez Canal. World politics did not trouble him at all, but he had a great occult power amongst his own people. It was all one to us who owned the ship. He had to employ white men in the shipping part of his business, and many of those he so employed had never set eyes on him from the first to the last day. I myself saw him but once, quite accidentally, on a wharf, an old, dark little man, blind in one eye, in a snowy robe and yellow slippers. He was having his hand severely kissed by a crowd of Malay pilgrims to whom he had done some favor, in the way of food and money. His almsgiving, I have heard, was most extensive, covering almost the whole archipelago. For isn't it said, that the charitable man is the friend of Allah? Excellent and picturesque Arab owner, about whom one needed not to trouble one's head, a most excellent Scottish ship, for she was that from the keep up excellent sea boat, easy to keep clean, most handy in every way, and if it had not been for her internal propulsion, worthy of any man's love, I cherish to this day a profound respect for her memory. As to the kind of trade she was engaged in, and the character of my shipmates, I could not have been happier if I had had the life, and the men made to my order by a benevolent enchanter. And suddenly I left all this. I left it in that, to us, inconsequential manner in which a bird flies away from a comfortable branch. It was as though all unknowing I had heard a whisper or seen something. Well, perhaps. One day I was perfectly right, and the next everything was gone. Glamour, flavor, interest, contentment, everything. It was one of these moments, you know. The green sickness of late youth descended on me, and carried me off. Carried me off that ship, I mean. We were only four white men on board, with a large crew of Kalashes and two Malay petty officers. The captain stared hard, as if wondering what ailed me. But he was a sailor, and he too, had been young at one time. Presently a smile came to lurk under his thick iron gray mustache, and he observed that, of course, if I felt I must go he couldn't keep me by main force. And it was arranged that I should be paid off the next morning. As I was going out of his cabin he added suddenly, in a peculiar wistful tone, that he hoped I would find what I was so anxious to go and look for. A soft, cryptic utterance which seemed to reach deeper than any diamond hard tool could have done. I do believe he understood my case. But the second engineer attacked me differently. He was a sturdy young Scot, with a smooth face and light eyes. His honest red countenance emerged out of the engine room companion, and then the whole robust man, with shirt sleeves turned up, wiping slowly the massive forearms with a lump of cotton waste. And his light eyes expressed bitter distaste, as though our friendship had turned to ashes. He said weightily, "Colin, oh, I've been thinking it was about time for you to run away home and get married to some silly girl." It was tacitly understood in the port that John Niven was a fierce misogynist, and the absurd character of the sally convinced me that he meant to be nasty, very nasty, had meant to say the most crushing thing he could think of. My laugh sounded deprecatory. Nobody but a friend could be so angry as that. I became a little crestfallen. Our chief engineer also took a characteristic view of my action, but in a kindlier spirit. He was young too, but very thin, and with a mist of fluffy brown beard all around his haggard face. All day long, at sea or in harbor, he could be seen walking hastily up and down the after deck, wearing an intense, spiritually rapt expression, which was caused by a perpetual consciousness of unpleasant physical sensations in his internal economy, for he was a confirmed dyspeptic. His view of my case was very simple. He said it was nothing but deranged liver. Of course. He suggested I should stay for another trip and meantime dose myself with a certain patent medicine in which his own belief was absolute. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll buy you two bottles, out of my own pocket. There. I can't say fairer than that, can I? I believe he would have perpetrated the atrocity or generosity at the merest sign of weakening on my part. By that time, however, I was more discontented, disgusted, and dogged than ever. The past 18 months, so full of new and varied experience, appeared a dreary, prosaic waste of days. I felt, how shall I express it? That there was no truth to be got out of them. What truth? I should have been hard put to it to explain. Probably, if pressed, I would have burst into tears simply. I was young enough for that. Next day the captain and I transacted our business in the harbor office. It was a lofty, big, cool, white room, where the screened light of day glowed serenely. Everybody in it, the officials, the public, were in white. Only the heavy polished desks gleamed darkly in a central avenue, and some papers lying on them were blue. Inner mouse punka sent from on high a gentle draft through that immaculate interior, and upon our perspiring heads. The official behind the desk we approached grinned amiably, and kept it up till, in answer to his perfunctory question, "Sign off and on again," my captain answered, "No. Signing off for good." And then his grin vanished in sudden solemnity. He did not look at me again till he handed me my papers with a sorrowful expression, as if they had been my passports for Hades. While I was putting them away he murmured some question to the captain, and I heard the latter answer good-humoredly, "No. He leaves us to go home." "Oh," the other exclaimed, nodding mournfully over my sad condition. I didn't know him outside the official building, Buddy leaned forward the desk to shake hands with me, compassionately, as one would with some poor devil going out to be hanged. And I am afraid I performed my part ungraciously, in the hardened manner of an impenitent criminal. No homeward bound mail boat was due for 3 or 4 days. Being now a man without a ship, and having for a time broken my connection with the sea become, in fact, a mere potential passenger, it would have been more appropriate, perhaps, if I had gone to stay at an hotel. There it was too, within a stone's throw of the harbor office, low, but somehow palatial, displaying its white, pillared pavilion surrounded by trim grass plots. I would have felt a passenger indeed in there. I gave it a hostile glance, and directed my steps toward the officer's sailor's home. I walked in the sunshine, disregarding it, and in the shade of the big trees on the esplanade without enjoying it. The heat of the tropical east descended through the leafy boughs, enveloping my thinly clad body, clinging to my rebellious discontent, as if to rob it of its freedom. The officer's home was a large bungalow with a wide veranda, and a curiously suburban-looking little garden of bushes, and a few trees between it and the street. That institution partook some, what of the character of a residential club, but with a slightly governmental flavor about it, because it was administered by the harbor office. Its manager was officially styled chief steward. He was an unhappy, wizened little man, who if put into a jockey's rig would have looked the part to perfection. But it was obvious that at some time or other in his life, in some capacity or other, he had been connected with the sea, possibly in the comprehensive capacity of a failure. I should have thought his employment a very easy one, but he used to affirm for some reason or other that his job would be the death of him someday. It was rather mysterious. Perhaps everything naturally was too much trouble for him. He certainly seemed to hate having people in the house. On entering it, I thought he must be feeling pleased. It was as still as a tomb. I could see no one in the living rooms, and the veranda too was empty, except for a man at the far end dozing prone in a long chair. At the noise of my footsteps he opened one horribly fish-like eye. He was a stranger to me. I retreated from there, and crossing the dining room, a very bare apartment with a motionless punkah hanging over the center table, I knocked at a door labeled in black letters, Chief Steward. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.